I recommend for folks that, you know, if you're in the grocery store and you're just looking at typical beef, typical chicken, or typical pork, choose the beef because it's still going to be better on a nutrition level, on an ethical level, and an environmental level than a typical chicken or typical pork.
Welcome to the show, Diana Rogers. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Colin, we know you're here too, and that's cool. Thanks for showing up. But more importantly, guest of the day is the important person. What do we need to know about you?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were asking Colin.
No, that's you. Nobody cares about Colin.
Okay. Basically, I noticed that people who are talking about sustainability and nutrition are largely focused on vegetarian and vegan type diets. And this book challenges that from a nutritional and environmental space, and also challenges the ethics of eating meat. So it can be really easy to say eating meat is bad or meat is murder. But when you fully understand the nutritional impact animals have on our health and the positive role livestock can play in our landscapes, then the ethical debate quickly becomes, if you actually want a diet of least harm, you should be eating large ruminants and not a vegan diet.
So what's your background? How did you get into the space of writing and talking about this?
So I've worked on farms ever since I was a teenager, and I've always been interested in health. I've always been interested in my nutrition. I found out when I was 26 that I have celiac disease, and so I was gluten-free for a while, but then decided to learn a little bit more about nutrition and entered the NTA program, Nutritional Therapy Association, and really learned more about real food nutrition. Got into paleo through Rob Wolf and his book, The Paleo Solution, and started a friendship with Rob that actually turned into this book. So once someone heals their own diet, they often then try to see what else they can do. You know, should they start a podcast? Should they, you know, write a book? And Rob and I felt like the sustainability piece was really, really an important argument to settle. And to have the nutrition, environmental, and ethical arguments all in one place, which currently they're not. So we put together this website to have all of that information right there. So we have these shareable infographics that tackle nutrition and environment. And halfway through writing the book, we decided to also make a film because people are largely digesting their media through film and not through books these days. And books will only reach, you know, the true believers in all of this. And I really wanted to change minds. The vegan propaganda films are quite effective and quite wrong.
Thanks,
and so we felt that making a film that was a counterpoint to a lot of those documentaries would allow for a more nuanced conversation, at least some kind of debate in the schools when they're showing these films. Of my son's high school showed Cowspiracy in science class.
Oh, gosh. I
didn't know that. And so we need something to counteract that so that the teachers aren't telling kids that, you know, they need to be eating Beyond Meat to be good environmental stewards, which is the dialogue is happening currently in my son's public high school.
Yeah, mass propaganda is what modern education has become, but maybe that's a topic for another day. So it's funny you said that you got into paleo through Rob Wolf, because I got into paleo through Rob Wolf back in the CrossFit days when he used to do certifications for CrossFit. And I went to one of those in Fort Lauderdale way back in the day. And so I've been following his work for years. So you feel like you've had to take up defense of the sacred cow, basically, you know, because obviously it's so attacked and it's so easy to blame meat and whatever. And so it says right here, why well-raised meat is good for you and good for the planet. Can you expand on that a little bit?
So nutritionally, all meat is healthy. The studies against meat are poor science, and meat is something that humans have eaten for 3.5 million years. There's never been a vegan hunter-gatherer diet, just a gatherer diet. Mm-hmm. There are nutrients in meat that we cannot get in plants. So in the nutrition section, we go through all of the claims against meat. Meat causes cancer. Meat causes heart disease. Meat causes diabetes and obesity. Clearly, we're eating too much meat. We actually challenge the protein guidelines and talk about why more protein than the RDA is actually optimal. Mm-hmm. But then when we get to the environmental section, we're really arguing for better meat. So that's meat that's raised in a regenerative way. And so currently our food system is failing. It's destroying our topsoil, our waterways. And when we graze cattle in a way that actually mimics how the wild herds in Africa are grazing, so or the bison before we got rid of all the bison. So large herds that give heavy impact actually on the land, but then move quickly off. Mm-hmm. When we manage cattle in that way, we're actually improving grasslands, because that's grasslands co-evolved with ruminant animals, and they need grazing animals in order to be healthy, and so do humans.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it seems like, and maybe you know the answer to this question, I mean, what would happen if we got rid of all the ruminants? Has there been any speculation on that? Because obviously it's a part, you know, this is a part of the balanced ecosystem. And I wonder if there would be some downstream effects of that if we just like said, you know, they're all gone overnight.
Well, there was a study that was done on what would happen to the American food system if we got rid of all animal products from our food system.
Okay, so that's interesting.
And that one found, it modeled it, and it found that greenhouse gas emissions would only go down about 2.5%. Overall in America, but nutrient deficiencies would go up. Overall caloric intake would go up and carbon intake would go up. Mm-hmm. And so when we're looking at a population that's already 70% overweight or obese, we don't need more calories and we don't need more carbs in order to solve those problems. What we need is more nutrition, and meat delivers that. It's highly satiating. It's got a lot of what we need that we can't get from plants in a very low calorie way. And this push towards the plant-based diet is really largely pushed by Hollywood and, you know, celebrities, vegan bloggers, people that really aren't grounded in science. There's just not evidence to show that that is the optimal diet for humans. And there's a lot of people that go about it in quite an uneducated way. There's a lot of people that don't have the privilege to push away meat that actually need a lot more meat than what they're getting, especially when we look outside of the U.S., but even in the U.S., we actually, most people, in my opinion, are not eating enough protein.
Yeah. Well, and also I bet you that model didn't account for the healthcare costs, the shipping, the transportation, the storage of these mass produced monocrops. Like, I suspect that there would actually be a net increase in carbon house emissions if we went to more monocropping and more plant-based, because, you know, like you think about plants, it's a strip mining of nutrients from earth, whereas ruminant regenerative agriculture is usually a replenishing, and it's part of an ecosystem. So can you expand on the regenerative aspect just a little bit more, just so, because people hear this a lot, and we've had guests on the show, Joe Salatin and whatnot, and we talk about that, but what does that look like? Does that look like growing crops and then having ruminant animals eat that through, and then chickens at some part and then cows in another part? I've seen a lot of different models. Can you just kind of expand that a little bit, give us like an idea of what that looks like?
We have some great graphics on our website and an animation actually in the film that describe this really well visually, because it's a little difficult to just explain it. And actually in the book, we have a graphic too. But basically, there's a big difference between continuous grazing and moving the cattle in an adaptive way frequently that really impacts how ecosystem function works. And so if you were to have two different fields, each one is 100 acres, and you have 100 head of cattle. In the first field, you turn them out for the entire summer on just the 100 acres. What's going to happen in that situation is that the animals are going to go around, they're going to overgraze their favorite, you know, because it's not just grass. It's a pasture is a diverse mix of lots of different plants. Mm-hmm. They're going to go around, they're going to find their favorite plants, they're going to eat them down and kill them. And then they're going to avoid the other plants and they're going to take over. So it actually ends up being a less healthy pasture, first of all. You're going to have much more bald spots on the pasture because of the overgrazing. You're going to have sicker animals because of the parasite pressure. So if one animal has a parasite infection and it goes around pooping everywhere, and then the other cows are grazing right where it was, they're all going to pick up that parasite, and it's never actually going to get taken out of that herd. Now, if you were to take that same 100 acres and 100 cattle and divide it into 10-acre paddocks, and this might be different in Nevada versus Vermont, right? It all depends on how lush the pasture is, how much rain you're getting, all that kind of stuff. So I'm just using you know, just theoreticals mm-hmm. because hundreds are easy. So if we were to take that and then divide it into smaller sections and move the cattle on a daily basis, some people move multiple times a day, some people move every other day. But the idea is that the cattle are in a concentrated area. They eat everything down at an even level so that not one plant gets overgrazed and killed and the weeds get eaten at the same rate as everything else. When you then move the cattle off and that grass has a chance and the pasture has a chance to grow back and rest and not get overeaten, that's when the magic happens. That's when the carbon can get sequestered. That's when the birds can come along and pick off those parasites that were laid down just by that one animal. And the animal is much less likely to pass them on to the rest of the herd because they're moving so quickly and not just eating the same, you know, poopy grass all the time. So, and in this situation, you're providing much better habitat for birds, cleaner water, the soil becomes more spongy and actually absorbs rainfall much better. So there's just a ton of benefits to that type of grazing.
So how is that compared to the way most cattle are raised in America?
So I just described the continuous grazing. Right. So the continuous grazing is how most cattle are raised in America.
And so then that's just a fixed area and they stay there and they just trampling it down, eating the same things, and then they get shipped off to feedlots basically.
For approximately the last 3 months of their life. Yes.
Okay. So yeah, that's actually something that Lauren, I think a lot of people think that cattle just are on a feedlot their whole life. So can you talk about a little bit about the way traditional beef is done?
So all cattle start out at a calf-cow operation on grass with their moms, and then they're either finished on grass or finished in a feedlot for the approximately 3 months of their life. Over the course of their entire life, the overall grain consumption of a typical beef animal is only about 10% of their overall diet is actually grain. So it's not like grain-fed beef. So I believe that even typical beef has been way over-vilified.
Yeah,
I'm not endorsing feedlot practices by any means, but I think there are lots of areas of gray. I don't think that it needs to be, you know, grass-fed good, grain-fed bad in every case. And I think that people should just buy the best meat that they can afford to buy and support local farmers when they have access to local farmers. Because a lot of times on the feedlot, they're also eating things like spent grain from the distillery process that would emit greenhouse gases if we didn't feed it to a cow and turn it into meat anyway. So cattle can really, what they do is they upcycle nutrient poor foods that we largely cannot eat, and they turn it into protein. And that's a very different thing than chicken or pork, because those are monogastric animals like us. They don't have a ruminant four-chamber stomach where they can eat lots of fibrous materials and actually turn that into protein. So pigs and chickens actually compete directly with humans for food. They're eating soy and corn 100% of the time, where cattle actually, you know, their overall diet is a very small percent is actually grain in a typical beef system. And then, of course, in a grass-fed system, it's 100% not competing with humans for food. And, you know, when you see people talking about, well, you know, if it takes an acre to feed a cow, but on that acre, we could grow 500 pounds of potatoes or whatever. What we have to realize is that not all land can actually be tilled up and cropped because, you know, it's either too hilly, too rocky, or, you know, a number of reasons why certain land can only be grazed. And so we can take this marginal land that can't be cropped and we can actually graze animals on it and turn that land into much healthier land from the impact of the grazing animals and grow food. So it's a really great system.
Yeah. So can you talk about how people have this idea that, you know, green is good, green is healthy, plants are the best thing or whatever, you know, if a cow can eat green plants, then what humans can as well. You mentioned the ruminant stomach and basically the conversion of cellulose into energy, which is what a cow does. Humans can't just eat grass. It would probably kill us actually, right? If we just try to eat grass in the lawn, you know? So can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So a cow is actually not the one digesting the food. It's the bacteria in their stomachs that's digesting the food. And we don't have a four-chamber stomach with rumen that's digesting the food and translating it into fatty acids for us. So it's just a completely different digestive system. A lot of people will look at gorillas and say, well, they're, you know, we kind of look like gorillas, and gorillas, you know, generally eat mostly plants. And so we should be able to as well. But the way we evolved, the reason why we have such large brains is because of our meat consumption and our digestive system. We are omnivores, 100%. We're not carnivores, although there are some people that are eating only meat and seem to be doing okay. We're not naturally herbivores, although it does seem that there are some people that can kind of get away with a vegan diet plus supplements. Mm-hmm. But the ideal diet, if you're just looking at the food and not counting supplements or expensive ultra-processed fortified veggie burgers and things like that, is a diet that's based on our ancestral hunter-gatherer diet, which is a combination of meats and plants. And so, you know, that's what we see in very different ratios all over the world. So moving in more tropical regions, you know, some people relied a little bit more on fruits and tubers. In the more Arctic regions, it was, you know, seal. So it really, you know, humans can thrive on a wide variety of macronutrient ratios. But what we constantly see is when you introduce ultra-processed modern foods, that's when we start to see problems.
Yeah. Yeah. And also our guts are not the same as gorillas. That's why gorillas and monkeys are stuck in the forest still eating plants and bugs sitting there, and we build iPhones and stuff. So
right.
That's all part of the evolution.
We would have to be eating all day long, and that's largely what vegans
chewing
are
all
doing.
Day
they're eating all day long, and people who eat more animal-sourced foods don't have to eat as often because they're fuller and they're more satiated. They have the nutrition that they need.
Yep, absolutely. So I've seen you in some of the comments having those vegan debates where they come on and they have their things to say and they pick out, cherry pick certain things or say this research or that research. What's your strategy for dealing with that? Do you just try to take it one argument at a time, or do you just have some like common things that you go back to? What's your argument against kind of the vegan and the ethical side of meat eating?
Well, it can be largely a game of whack-a-mole. So you kind of like, you know, you hit one argument and they'll say, well, then what about water? And then you kind of describe the water and why that methodology is wrong. And they'll say, yeah, but the greenhouse gases. Well, yeah, but it's just wrong. You know, like, okay, it's just wrong. So in the beginning of the book, we actually do take all the most common questions and concerns about meat and tell you where you can find those answers specifically in the book. So does meat cause cancer? Page, you know, blah, blah, blah. Mm. And that's why we also developed, you know, individual infographics that deal with each one. But it can be frustrating on social media because I'll post an infographic about why it doesn't take 10 bathtubs full of water in order to make a hamburger. But then they'll say, yeah, but it takes all this feed. And they're inefficient with feed, and we should just be eating that feed directly instead of feeding it to cattle. So then I have to post the feed one, and then they'll say, yeah, but they're emitting methane, and methane is bad, and it's 10 times worse than carbon dioxide. And so, and what about the water? Mm-hmm, and so it's just like, it's just constant back and forth, and it can definitely get exhausting. So that's why, you know, we wrote the book, is really just to have all of that information in one place, because especially when we get to the ethical arguments, you really cannot have an intelligent ethical argument without understanding nutrition and food systems.
Yeah. So talk to me about the film.
Real quick, do you think you've changed anyone's mind that argued with you on Instagram?
I've had people come to me in private messages saying that they used to be really threatened by the things I would say. They used to be vegan, and now they're not. And it's largely from my work.
That's cool. Awesome.
I try to avoid, you know, back and forth battles because those tend to just not work. And so I just don't think they're effective at changing someone's mind. I think, you know, you have to tell them something that challenges their worldview, and then they have to go back and sit on it for a little bit. And then they come back and maybe digest some more information and start thinking, and maybe their health starts failing. And then they, you know, kind of look into the nutrition piece, and then they maybe, you know, so some of my best followers are ex-vegans and vegetarians. Mm.
Yeah. And also, it's not like you're going to convince a person arguing. That usually doesn't work. But there's a lot of people that read those threads. Maybe somebody's on the fence, or maybe somebody gets a little bit of nudge in the right direction, or they read enough of it and their mind does start to shift. I think you get a lot more people on the fence than you do those like diehards that are just like attacking anything that you say, right? Like the whack-a-mole style, you know? Mm-hmm. So there is merit sometimes to having those discussions for other people, not necessarily the person you're arguing with. So about the film, is it done or is it in production or what's the status of that? Because I know making a film is like a big, big process. And it seems like you announced this pretty recently. You raised a campaign for this, right?
Yeah. So we did a couple crowdfunding campaigns. We've had some corporate sponsorship. We had some individual donors and the film is completely done.
Awesome.
I have the DVDs sitting actually right behind my computer DVDs. On the table. And we're going to be doing an online 1 week free screening of the film this fall on sacredcow.info before it releases to the major streaming platforms. So we're negotiating with them right now. So I can't say where it's going to hit first, but folks can go to sacredcow.info and sign up for my newsletter and then be the first to find out how they can watch the film for free. So it's going to be 1 week only this fall. And, you know, we're not announcing the date yet. It's kind of hinging on a few other appearances that we have going on, but yeah, it's 100% done. Nick Offerman from Parks and Rec is the narrator of the film, which is really great. He's a huge supporter of the work we're doing. We have a lot of really great farmers in there, a lot of familiar health experts to people who are already in the ancestral health space. Mark Hyman, Chris Kresser, Rob Wolf, of course, Nina Teicholz, Zoe Harkham, Mark Hyman? And then we went all over the world. We went to Belgium and filmed with a butcher there. We went to England and filmed with a sheep farmer in Northern England. And my favorite shoot was actually down in Chihuahua, Mexico, where these collective of ranchers is actually regenerating 1 million acres of degraded desert back into grasslands. It's pretty impressive. And they're doing it all with cattle.
Can you talk about that? What does that look like? So they're taking cattle and they're putting on desert and it's somehow causing grass to grow? Like what exactly are
they doing?
Yeah,
so there's a seed bank. So the Chihuahuan Desert used to be grasslands. Grass is tall as, you know, taller than me, but through bad management practices, it has become a desert. And so a lot of people will look and say, well, it's desert, but it's not naturally a desert. It's a desert because we got rid of all the bison and all the other grazing animals, and the plants didn't have the nutrients they needed from the manure. They didn't have anyone chewing it to stimulate growth. And so it gradually just kind of turned into desert, or it was overgrazed and turned into desert. So there's undergrazing and overgrazing causes of desertification. But what we can do with cattle is take the cattle, move them frequently, like I described before. Their manure and urine is actually moving moisture all over this desert, stimulating the seeds that are latent, that are just sitting in the soil waiting for the right conditions to sprout again, and increasing the water holding capacity. So dung beetles are taking the manure and bringing it down into the soil. Other microbes and animals are making tunnels in there, so they're allowing the water to get in. The more carbon you have in the soil, the more water you can trap in the soil. Mm. So it's just this rebounding effect. And so this ranch that we went to in Mexico is seeing the return of endangered and rare birds because grasslands are their necessary habitat. Grasslands have what these birds need for food and for shelter. And, you know, when we turn everything into monocrop corn and spraying it with insecticides, we're getting rid of bird food and habitat. And so we can actually recreate all of that when we bring grazing animals back. And so it's a beautiful process. I mean, we were driving through, you know, from the Chihuahua airport, it was about a 2 or 3 hour drive on very bumpy dirt roads to get to this guy's ranch. And it was just dry, tumbleweedy, kind of like some scrubby mesquite, you know, dilapidated, you know, abandoned homes, things like that. But then we pull into his ranch. He gets the same exact amount of rainfall as, you know, the other side of the fence. But when you get onto his ranch, it is like you've gone to Eden. I mean, it is lush green grass and really healthy looking cattle. I mean, it's absolutely beautiful and astounding. And the amount of birds that I saw there was really, really impressive.
So how can people support these type of farmers, right? Like, because there's the ethics of buying feedlot beef and, you know, some people talk about, well, what you can afford or whatever. I mean, so what's some actionable ways that people can start sourcing beef better to support these things, but also support their health?
Buying from farms that do this. Blue Nest Beef is a company that actually sources from bird-friendly farms that do practices like what I was describing in Mexico. other regenerative farmers that are moving their cattle frequently. I mean, I highly encourage, if they have the opportunity, is to go to the farm or ranch or wherever they're buying their meat from and actually look around and, you know, are the animals on grass that's only a quarter of an inch high? Is there a lot of bald spots? Like, you can see a healthy pasture. It should be teeming with life. There should be a loud buzz of insects there. There should be lots of butterflies. There should be lots of bees, lots of life. That's what a healthy ecosystem looks like. You know, so you can go to a farm and actually see, if you can, what it looks like.
Yeah. So we had Joel Salton on. He actually said that if you're buying from, let's say, a beef farmer, and he or she doesn't invite you to the farm within like a few purchases, that might be a sign. and
yeah, I mean, it can be. Some farmers are just not people.
Sure.
You know, they're ranchers. I've met a lot, and they're just like, they want to just be with the cows, right?
Yeah.
So not all ranchers are set up for tourism. Some of them are worried about people coming onto the farm, and you know, it takes a lot of time to give someone a tour, and that's time that you're taking away from doing your job. And so I do sympathize with the farmers that maybe don't open up their farms to people. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if they do offer open houses, even a couple times a year, it's a great way to ask those questions and learn more about what they do.
Yeah.
See it for yourself.
So can you talk about the health aspects of meat a little bit? Some of the misconceptions you mentioned earlier about the certain nutrients not found in the plant kingdom that you have to get from animals. And I hear a lot of things like the plant-based argument is, well, you can get B12 from dirt. So can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, people don't eat enough dirt to get B12. That's ridiculous.
Well, that's true. Yeah. Their food's sterile and it's like bleached five times. So like,
yeah. So there's a lot of nutrients that are found in plants, but in much better quantities and much more bioavailable in the animal form too. So we've got B12, which is only found in animals, but then we have things like zinc, choline, vitamin A, athletes out there that eat total garbage and also do very well too. I mean, a lot of times, you know, what they're doing is they're taking people that won the genetic lottery and would probably thrive on any diet. Certainly were not born to vegan mothers and raised as vegans. So they converted to veganism more recently. And honestly, a lot of them are failing at it and going back to meat eating or getting crazy.
It's a snapshot of like their career maybe, or like they do a diet for a year and they talk about it's amazing. And then the effects finally kick in. And, or a lot of them are also doing exogenous hormonal substances. A lot of people don't realize how prevalent that is in fitness in general. So it's just like, it's like saying, oh, hey, look at me, look at the way my body looks and I eat this. So therefore, you know, you should eat this way too. And you'll get these results. Like, it's just like one of the biggest scams there is in fitness right now.
Right.
So, okay. What are some big points in the book that maybe we haven't talked about thus far that you're really trying to get out there? Some big ideas for people to consider or think about, or maybe even actionable things they can do in their everyday life.
Well, it's funny because in the end, so we do have a diet plan at the end of the book that's kind of like a whole 30 paleo keto-ish kind of blend of all those diets. We're not competing with anyone. You know, we're like, go do a whole 30 or go do keto if that's what works for you. We're a little higher in protein, pushing the protein in our recommendations, just because even with keto, I've found a lot of people overdo it on the fat and don't eat enough protein. And so we really stress the protein from animal sources as local and sustainable, regenerative as possible. Same with, you know, your vegetable sources as well. But then we also have other recommendations on what you can do to be just kind of more sustainable in the general population. And we wrote this before COVID. And it's funny because after COVID happened, I was like, oh my God, Rob, look. And I took a screenshot of our recommendations in the book and texted it to him. And he was like, oh my God. So, you know, we said things like keep yourself metabolically healthy so that you're not a burden on society. And, you know, because obesity, the job loss, the productivity loss of obesity is huge. We said, don't get into debt. Make sure you have some cash for if the economy collapses. You know,
I mean, it was like, you were predicting what's going on.
Yeah. I mean, he and I are kind of preppers anyway, a little bit in
our
heads.
And so I got my block of silver right here in my hand, actually.
Right. And try to support your local community more because the more local dollars that are floating around in your community, the stronger your local economy is going to be. You know, it's very dangerous with us buying so much on Amazon and allowing only a handful of companies to control our whole meat supply. And so what we saw during the beginning of COVID was a collapse in our meat system. And so, you know, at first I was like, oh my God, now people are finally going to listen to me because, you know, what I've been arguing for all along is actually happening and people need to start thinking about this stuff. People are definitely paying a lot more attention to how their food is sourced. Now everyone's turning into gardening. You know, that's the number one hobby of Americans is gardening. So all the seed companies actually, you know, couldn't sell seeds anymore. Like they closed down because, you know, they couldn't handle the demand. And so just different things like that, just getting your hands dirty, keeping yourself healthy, being a member of your community in any way you can. So all of those things are important.
Yeah. Can you talk about the protein real quick, maybe as a closing thought? Like why are people not eating enough protein? And what's some of maybe the, because I know there's been a lot of bad research trying to demonize protein, especially a lot of the research trying to demonize animal protein, right?
Mm-hmm. So the RDA for protein came about because of some really bad science. So what they were doing was looking at nitrogen balance studies. So that's when they were measuring nitrogen in. So it's looking at the protein you're eating. And then as soon as they could detect nitrogen coming out of you, as soon as they could stop detecting the nitrogen out, then they thought you reached your optimal protein level. Mm-hmm. But that's not taking into account all the other benefits of eating a high protein diet. So again, protein is the most satiating macronutrient. It's going to fill you up. And even if people did nothing else other than just jack up their protein, they're going to feel so full that they're going to naturally eat less of everything else. Yep. And when they're getting it from animal sources, they're also getting a lot of other micronutrients. And micronutrient deficiency also drives food cravings. And so, you know, if you're low on magnesium, you're going to crave chocolate more. That's just how it goes. And so when you have all the micronutrients and animal sources provide just about all of the micronutrients, definitely more so than a plant-based diet, you're just going to crave food less. So the current RDA for protein is 0.8 grams per kilogram of body weight. And Rob and I really look at a gram of protein per pound of body weight. And so starting women at least 100 grams of protein per day. Now, some people are fine with whatever diet they're eating, right? So if what folks are doing is working for them, that's great. But if you're suffering from a high stress, recovering from an injury, if you're over 40, if you're in a growth period of your life, if you have any sort of an autoimmune disease or any sort of disease at all, your protein requirements are much higher than a healthy 25-year-old person. But even if you're weightlifting, then your protein requirements are higher, right? So we really like to focus on more protein, but better protein. So getting it from animal sources, regenerative when possible. We also, you know, highly encourage fish, shellfish. I mean, oysters are off the charts for micronutrients, especially zinc. And wild meats, definitely, if folks have access to that. Chicken and pork really should be at the bottom of the animal protein list.
Yes. Actually, why is that?
So red meat is about 30% more nutrient dense than chicken, number one. But then also when you look at the ethics of how industrial chicken and pork are raised, those animals are 100% indoors under really crappy conditions their entire lives, eating grain that is grown in such a horrible way. And it's very, very difficult to source pastured poultry in particular, but also better too. Pork.
If you do find it, it's expensive, yeah.
Yeah. And so I recommend for folks that, you know, if you're in the grocery store and you're just looking at typical beef, typical chicken, or typical pork, choose the beef because it's still going to be better on a nutrition level, on an ethical level, and an environmental level than typical chicken or typical pork. And you're much less likely to get a foodborne illness. You're way more likely to get salmonella from chicken than E. coli from beef.
Is that because just the processing and like the mass production of it?
It has a bunch of reasons why.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And poultry has no humane slaughter standards at all, where large ruminants do. And so that's just another reason why I choose larger ruminants. I mean, one beef cow is about 500 pounds of meat. And think about how many chickens you would need to kill to get that much meat.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, this has been great. So where can people learn more about you, the book, the film, and everything? Mm-hmm. We'll have links to everything, of course, in the show notes.
Yep. Sacredcow.info is the site for all of that stuff. So they can sign up for my newsletter and find out how the film is going to come out, when. So just keep an eye out for those emails and make sure you're accepting them and opting in. We also have information on the book there. I'm on social media at Sustainable Dish on Instagram.
Sustainable Dish.
And so we have a podcast, Sustainable Dish Podcast. I also have another website, sustainabledish.com, which is more focused on my nutrition practice. So I'm a clinician and I, you know, help people with weight loss and, you know, healthy eating and gut stuff. I really focus on metabolic health and gut health. And so that's my nutrition practice and my clinician hat.
Well, I didn't know that. I have a question now for you specifically about gut health.
Okay.
So I eat probably an 80 to 90% carnivore diet myself. And I've been opening up a little bit more into, you know, various plant things that don't affect me as much. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just wondering, what are some good gut support? Like I have this probiotic yogurt I take. It's pretty good. It's grass-fed yogurt. I mean, should I be looking into other probiotics, prebiotics? What should I be looking for? What are some good strategies?
You know, there just hasn't been a lot of research on that. And so it's really hard for me to comment. There's some good probiotics out there that are soil-based that are actually fantastic. Terra Nova, I think, is one of them. You know, starches are prebiotic. And so there is a good case to eat some, a little bit potatoes and other like starchy tubers once in a while and other fruits and just whole vegetables, right? So just avoiding like, you know, ultra processed acellular carbohydrates. But we really just don't know much about what makes the perfect microbiome, even if taking yogurt has any long-term effects. We really just don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, is the biome driving your health or is your health driving the biome? We don't even know that. So eventually there will be a lot more research into that. People will have their biome tested and will be able to generate diets specifically catered to that biome and blood type and genetics and all that. But just right now, it's just such in its infancy. And, you know, I really, much more of my focus is just getting people off sugar and processed foods.
Of course. Right.
And just tackling those big things. And then once we get into like, should I be 90% carnivore? Should I be 80? You know, that's not the population that I work with.
Yeah. So final question, what's your favorite way to prepare steak?
Seared in a cast iron pan.
Well, that's mine as well. Literally, usually it's done in about, with resting 10 minutes and I have my entire meal. I have a 10 ounce steak, I'm done, right? So no excuses. Okay, it's been a pleasure. We really appreciate you coming on.
Okay.
And we will see you later.
All right, thank you so much.
Please always remember that the members of the Ancestral Mind podcast are not, in fact, medical professionals. They're not doctors. They're not nutritionists. They are simply providing this entertainment for you to do your own research and to entertain yourselves. So please consult a physician before changing your diet. Not everything works for everybody. And make sure you always do your own research on everything you hear on this show and outside.